This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, ominous similarities between the coronavirus and the 2008 financial crisis. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Roger Hearing in London, where we're looking at an economy hitting the pause button and what's left for the Bank of England at their monthly meeting after two surprise rate cuts in a row.
I'm Amy Morris. The coronavirus pandemic is already having an impact on the business of government in Washington.
And in Asia, King Dollar, the sledgehammer. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak. On Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the shadow of the 2008 financial crisis. Bloomberg Opinion's John Authors joins us for some insight into what to expect, what he expects. John, you call it the Lehman echoes. What are some of the ominous signs we should be watching for as we move into the coming week?
Well, you obviously need to look, first of all, whether liquidity dries up. For example, you're seeing a run on a number of big emerging market currencies that haven't really been hit by the coronavirus at all, but are now going to be in serious difficulties. This is very similar to what we saw after Lehman when you suddenly had a range of corporate bankruptcies in the emerging world when nobody had really expected that.
Now, when you say that we should watch for liquidity drying up, aren't central banks around the world watching for that and trying to prevent that?
They certainly are, but again, you need, this is another Lehman echo. They are making things up as they go along, as many of us. You have the example, the latest new acronym is the PEP. From the ECB. Remember, again, in 2008, there was a succession of new acronyms, new attempts at unusual programs for supporting the market. And that, again, is very reminiscent of what we saw, of what we're beginning to see now, that the central banks will try something, it won't quite work. Then they'll try something else. So, yes, they are certainly, plainly, we'll be learning lessons. People know what happened in 08, and that's affecting the way they're behaving. But this is still an extreme enough situation that, in many cases, they're not getting it right on the first attempt, that people, that central banks are needing to try and try again.
Let's talk about circuit breakers and the U.S. market. Even one time is jarring. We've seen them triggered several times in the past week. Good for stability, or do they actually engender more panic?
I would say on balance, in the last week or two, they probably have actually done the job that they were intended to do. In that the trading gap is not that long, 15 minutes, and you have on a number of occasions seen fairly direct vertical selling stopped and slightly more disciplined trading happening once they come back. I wouldn't want to go too far with this. Previous examples of circuit breakers have been very counterproductive. You're right, they can just scare people. But on this occasion, I suspect that they haven't made things any worse and might have made things slightly better.
Now, 15 minutes is a far cry from just a prolonged shutdown of financial markets. What would that mean for us? What would the psychological impact be there?
If we shut down for a while, plainly that would only be part of a very of a very wide shutdown, of other institutions within society. You have seen that. You have seen a broadening shutdown in the last few days. In terms of closing the markets, the argument in favor, I suppose the simplest argument in favor of doing that is, if you're closing down the economy, you might as well, you probably should close down the market as well. The other very key argument, I suppose, is about uncertainty, which is that there is such radical uncertainty about the extent of the damage that the economic damage that the virus is going to cause, that to some extent we shouldn't be trying to trade long-term instruments like stocks at all. It's just guesswork. They're only going to be very volatile. So those are some of the arguments that these are sufficiently unusual times that it really would be dangerous to allow the market to continue to trade. I will say this is something that's different from Lehman, that there have been far more voices saying they'd actually like the markets to close this time than there were back in 2008.
All right. Thank you, John. Bloomberg Opinions, John Authors. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, King Dollar and a look at the implications for emerging markets. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Up later in our program, the disruptive dollar and the havoc King Dollar has been causing in Asia. But first, as the UK implements drastic measures to contain the coronavirus, the Bank of England pulls out another surprise interest rate move ahead of its next scheduled meeting. Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchors Caroline Hepker and Roger Hearing have more.
Bob, it had been thought the Bank of England, under the new governor, Andrew Bailey, would wait until the scheduled meeting to take further action to support the economy. But instead, they cut interest rates and cancelled annual stress tests for the banks. So, what's left for the MPC to consider next week?
Well, joining us now is Bloomberg's senior UK economist, Dan Hansen. So interest rates have been cut to 0.1% now. Is there anything else that the Bank of England could do next week?
I think the short answer to that is no right now. I mean, I think they've done an enormous amount. We've seen, as you said there, interest rates cut from a little over 2 weeks ago. They were up at 0.75%. They're down at 0.1%. So they've done 65 basis points of easing there. And they've ramped up their quantitative easing program. They're buying another £200 billion worth of assets, which is an enormous amount. I mean, if you look back through history, the Bank of England, on these QE announcements, have normally bought at the maximum £75 billion. So it's an enormous amount of easing that they've done. If you just add up the QE and the rate cuts together, we think it amounts to something in the region of 225 basis points. So, as I say, it's an enormous amount, and I think the March meeting is very much a point they can sit back and consider what they've done and what could potentially come next. I mean, I think what we're going to be looking for is, first of all, any guidance about what the bank's going to be looking at, how long this policy stance is going to stay in place, and also whether they develop their thinking about the actual size of the shock that's going to hit the UK economy. What's really important is that, well, we know it's going to be big. What's really important is how long is it going to last and whether the bank has developed its thinking around that.
I suppose the point really is if anything they've announced so far actually helps. The huge, as you say, QE program, it's all out there, the cut in the rates. Is there a sense that it will help? It is enough, if nothing else, just to build confidence?
I think you can think about it in two parts. So the first part yesterday was very much the QE program was a lot about ensuring efficient market functioning. We saw yields spike up over recent days, and that got the bank very worried, clearly. Gilts were being dumped, investors were moving towards cash, that sort of flight to safety. And the UK's got an enormous current account deficit, so the UK is very vulnerable in that sort of situation. And the bank has essentially just gone into the market, and the QE program is going to be enacted very quickly. They're going to start buying these bonds very, very quickly. So that is the first part of it, and that is a positive move. The second part of it is really whether all of this is going to do something for the economy. And we think it will. As I said, 225 basis points of easing is no mean feat. It's significant. And when you combine it with the fiscal efforts that are going on, it lowers the chances, I think that's the best way of putting it, that this shock lingers for a very long time. As I said, it's going to be big in the second quarter. What we want to avoid, and the authorities want to avoid, is that it creates mass unemployment and the economy takes a very long time to recover going forward.
Is it really going to be that sudden and dramatic of a stop in the UK economy? Because I note that Boris Johnson and the measures that are being brought in, you know, to encourage this kind of social distancing, schools being closed, they're not being enacted as quickly as they were or as thoroughly as they have been in Wuhan and in Italy. So it may not be that sudden stop here.
No, that is possible. I mean, I think what you've seen from the government is that it's playing catch-up, and it's playing catch-up very, very quickly. And you can imagine that the measures that have been introduced become even more draconian, and they become more draconian quite quickly. The politics is changing almost by the hour around this issue. Now, in terms of what it means to the economy, I mean, as the measures become more draconian, obviously the chances of a very significant sudden stop increase. But if the government continues to sticks with its social distancing policies and policies to what they describe as flattening the curve and pushing the peak of the virus, the number of virus cases in the UK into the summer, and they think social distancing is the way to do that, then this potentially becomes more of a U-shape type shock to the UK economy. You just have a prolonged period of weakness rather than a very big period of weakness followed by somewhat of a rebound. So in terms of the economic impact, the thing to actually watch is what the government does and the measures it puts in. The more draconian they become, the sharper the sudden stop becomes.
Now, Dan, one of the other eye-catching things that was done was a cancelling of the stress tests for significant banks, including Barclays, Lloyds Banking Group, Nationwide Building Society. I mean, I suppose you could argue that they're going through the stress at the moment, so perhaps a test isn't relevant. But does it matter that these have been cancelled?
I mean, I'm not sure that it does. I mean, what I think the bank has been clear about is that some of the tests that have been done in the recent past, in recent years, have been very, very significant material shocks to not only the UK, but the global economy. And one thing to say about all that is that they put through the sort of shocks that they've been putting through in these scenarios is massive demand shocks and also shocks where sterling falls quite significantly and the bank actually has to go ahead and lift interest rates to try and keep inflation in check. What we're seeing is something very different to that now, of course. We've just spoken about the significant easing that the Bank of England is going through. Yes, there is going to be pressure on the banking sector, of course, but I think there's a lot of measures beyond the monetary policy measures that have been introduced, such as reducing the countercyclical capital buffer, such as the term funding scheme, which is put in place to ensure that banks have cheap funding. The Bank of England is really pulling all the levers at its disposal to ensure that the banking system continues to function. And what is currently a shock that is emanating from the virus doesn't turn into a credit crunch, because that would make things a lot worse.
Thanks very much to Bloomberg's senior UK economist Dan Hansen for joining us. I'm Roger Hearing in London.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 5 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
All right. Thank you, Caroline and Roger. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, King Dollar or Fling Dollar? And a look at the implications for Asia. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. And coming up, Washington in the time of coronavirus, the challenges for politicians and policymakers. But first, the coronavirus isn't the only thing aggravating some investors. There's the recent volatility of the U.S. currency. And for more, we go to Hong Kong and Bloomberg Daybreak Asia host Brian Curtis.
Bob, thank you. Well, King Dollar and the role it's playing in stoking volatility. That's what we're looking at here with Mark Cranfield from the Bloomberg Markets Live blog. Mark, it seems like, well, let me ask you this way. Is the dollar causing volatility or is it coincident with it?
A little bit of both. There's obviously a global grab for U.S. dollars, partly as a funding tool. In addition to all of the anxiety that markets are having over the coronavirus, we're also coming up to the end of the first quarter, which is especially important in the Japanese world. It's the end of their financial year. So there would already be a big demand for US dollars for people to balance their books. That, of course, is being made much worse by the fact that now people are reducing risk all over the place. And that is being seen through some extreme movements in dollar funding tools. And then it feeds back into the US dollar currency itself. So for some people who are unable to simply borrow some short-term US dollars, they just need to go and buy the dollars that they require. Now, among many places where this is going to get very uncomfortable, of course, is in the emerging market world, because those currencies tend to react very fast. When the dollar is strong, those currencies tend to weaken very quickly. So you have a flip side effect there. And it even, of course, extends to the major currency world as well. We've seen the pound sterling has fallen to levels that we haven't seen since the 1980s against the U.S. dollar this week. So
yeah,
pretty
just the latest
moves everywhere, right?
In addition to the pound, the yuan, the Aussie, and the Kiwi this past week.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it seems only a few days ago that we were talking about would Aussie against the U.S. drop below 60 cents. So pretty significant declines there, and we've got a Reserve Bank of Australia with the possibility of going to quantitative easing, and that would be a new thing in this part of the world. We've not had Australia or New Zealand consider such a thing before. So these are interesting times, and people are really having to think out of the box. How can they cope with one of the problems, which is the very strong US dollar?
In a sense, this could be failure, I suppose, for central banks, because it seems the more that they ease, the more traders just add dollars to their pile.
It certainly is a very difficult situation for them. There is a risk that investors feel central banks are running out of tools. We already have the U.S. has now moved to virtually zero interest rates. In Europe and Japan, we've been in negative interest rates for a long period of time already, and we haven't seen major recoveries in those markets. So now with the three of the major central banks in the world effectively running out of bullets, as it were, in terms of purely interest rate cuts, there is certainly a risk that investors say, okay, then they can't help us anymore, so we just have to take it into our own hands. We just have to have the most liquid, most defensive currency that we can get our hands on. And in most cases, that would be the U.S. dollar.
Now, you mentioned the yen already, and in some ways the yuan had been holding up, but it seems like it has succumbed like all the others.
A little bit against the U.S. dollar, but if you consider the yuan on the wider basis, if you look at the yuan basket, which is actually from the PBOC's point of view, when the Chinese authorities look at it, they're really more interested in how the yuan is doing against all of its trading partners. And on that basis, it's very strong. The yuan overall is extremely strong, although it has weakened slightly against the U.S. dollar, but it's strong against its partners. But even the move against the U.S. dollar is relatively small in comparison to how the dollar has performed against most of the G10 currencies.
When things get this one-sided, indeed we had the Bank of Korea saying that things were just so lopsided, is it worth it for central banks to try to fight back?
As they know from past experience, it's not easy. Sometimes it just makes it worse, as you were suggesting. It can end up being very one-sided. We are getting into the kind of territory now where they really will have to think about maybe some things they never tried before. Even the possibility of having to shut the foreign exchange market for a day or two is something they may even need to discuss here, because it's becoming irrational. It's, the price gap movements are becoming so extreme, and banks are probably having difficulty in, with the settlement side of things as well. What they don't want is to create a banking crisis out of a foreign exchange crisis. It's bad enough that financial markets appear to be out of control, but if that feeds back into causing liquidity issues at a major bank, then that would be much worse. So they're probably considering all kinds of things, and maybe even a market closure is along the lines as well.
All right, Mark, thank you very much for joining us and shedding some light on this. That is Mark Cranfield from the Bloomberg Markets Live blog. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong on Bloomberg Daybreak Asia. You can catch us every weekday here beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thank you, Brian. And coming up, coronavirus and politics. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. The coronavirus is a huge challenge for politicians and policymakers in Washington, but it's also an opportunity. And for more, we head to the Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington and Amy Morris. Amy.
All right. Thank you, Bob. We are joined now by Bloomberg U.S. Politics editor Kathleen Hunter. Kathleen, I want to thank you for taking the time with us. This is a really hectic and busy time. We want to ask you a little bit about how the world is sort of navigating its way through this coronavirus pandemic. We want to look ahead at some of the long-term implications, especially here in the U.S. Let's just start with what this could mean for using the military for health-related emergencies. We have seen this come up time and again for things like hurricanes or other natural disasters, but now we're talking about for a health-related national emergency.
I think it raises some questions about, you know, assuming everybody, you know, once everyone kind of gets past this current crisis, you know, in the future, if there's a bad flu outbreak, or we've seen, you know, measles outbreaks across the country, does this now set a precedent for involving the military in a way that it typically hasn't been involved, except for, you know, more in situations like weather disasters, that sort of thing? And I think that it does set that precedent, and if, you know, we do see states and the federal government, you know, through the use of the National Guard, trying to rely more on the military in on a more regular type basis, I think that might give a lot of people pause. So certainly it's one of the many aspects of, you know, public life and private life, really, that's being influenced and could potentially be reshaped by this whole crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people, when they first hear that the National Guard is being mobilized, it kind of makes you stop and think for a second when you realize what they're doing is getting medical supplies to the places that need it, or, you know, being able to hand out food, like food lines for areas that maybe don't have enough supplies at this point. That's what they're being utilized for. It's not like they're cordoning off streets yet.
Correct. And I think that, you know, it definitely, you know, it, I think gives a lot of people pause, you know, as you say, to hear that. But again, I think it's important to remember, particularly with the National Guard, that the National Guard kind of has a dual function. You know, they're really meant and are created to assist, you know, domestically the public in these types of emergencies. They are very different from the, you know, traditional military, which doesn't really have the power to act on U.S. soil. The National Guard can be nationalized, essentially, where they have these more broad functions. But I think that, you know, it is important to remember that it is different from having, you know, the regular U.S. Army coming up. And I think part of why there's some confusion is because, you know, a lot of National Guard troops have been very involved in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which have gone on for a very long time. So people, I think, tend to think about them more in that capacity rather than in their sort of, you know, public service, domestic capacity.
Now let's turn to the more civilian side of the federal government and the business of government, Kathleen. D.C., traditionally a telework-healthy area, the federal government has had continuity of operations policies in place for decades. We call them COOP policies, and has traditionally been a leader in telework, at least for some federal agencies. Where do you see this going as far as working from home becoming more accepted, not just in federal life, but also in private service as well? Working from home is what everybody is trying to pull off right now.
Well, absolutely. And I think there are going to be very long-lasting changes just in the way, not just in Washington, but, you know, across the country and even across the globe, in how companies and also just workers look at the whole telework, work-from-home situation. You know, if we have a majority of people or a vast segments of the population for the next weeks or perhaps even several months working from home on a regular basis, I think we're going to see improvements in infrastructure and companies to allow that to happen. We're going to see attitudes about it change. We're going to see policies about it change to reflect that this is all going on. And then when, you know, hopefully everyone gets past this crisis, it's not like everything is going to go back to the way it was before. You know, we obviously are going to, I think, offices are going to reopen to all of their employees and people will go back to work. But I think that there will be probably a much greater acceptance of the idea that people could work from home even under normal circumstances, because everyone will have done it at the highest capacity with, you know, large segments, if not all of their companies, from working remotely and figured out new ways to make that work.
Let's apply that then to Capitol Hill and to lawmakers and the implications of a long-term shutdown.
Well, I think that, you know, we did hear from Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House this week, saying essentially that the members of the House, I guess she was under some pressure from those in her caucus to perhaps set up a situation where the House could vote remotely. She essentially rejected that idea out of hand and said, you know, we're the captains of the ship, we're the last to leave, i.e. that, you know, in her view, part of showing that leadership is for members of Congress to show up and to vote. So that is kind of the backdrop. That's the precedent. That's the tone that Pelosi is setting. But I think that, you know, that being said, we have seen an increase over the past several days in the number of lawmakers. We saw the first two earlier this week that were actually did come down with coronavirus symptoms and tested positive. We've seen a growing number of lawmakers that are self-quarantining. And, you know, at this very critical time when Congress is trying to essentially, in Mitch McConnell's words, work at warp speed to get through, stimulus packages that will blunt the impact on the economy, I think that, you know, it becomes more and more difficult for Congress to be in place physically to deal with this crisis as more and more people fall ill. And we're seeing this, you know, in legislatures again across the globe. In London, for instance, there's members of parliament were sitting, you know, 6 feet apart from each other while they were deliberating this week. And so I think what we're seeing is kind of this tension between members of Congress and legislators worldwide really needing to be performing, at the top of their game and really deliberating and debating and passing these important pieces of legislation that the circumstances are demanding at a time when, you know, the guidance overall is not to be around other people. So it creates a real dilemma. And I think it's a question of how long Congress is going to be able to tackle that.
Yeah, because there is no mechanism in place to be able to vote from home. And when asked about it, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made it clear he was not interested in trying to put something like that in place, that was not how they did business. Because, I mean, frankly, on a good day, if you had that mechanism in place where lawmakers could vote from home, they would never come to D.C. They would stay in their home districts. I'm wondering if Washington is going to come out of this changed. Are they going to start considering other ways to get those votes recorded, or are they going to be, I don't know, more cooperative on different pieces of legislation? We've seen quite a bit of cooperation just in the past week, cooperation that we had not seen previous to this.
I think that's absolutely true. I think to an extent those are somewhat separate but related, phenomenons at the moment. I think that, you know, Congress, like everybody, I think is going to, you know, undergo changes. Every segment of, you know, industry and public life is going to undergo changes because of this. I think that's part of why, though, we're seeing Pelosi and McConnell really push back so strongly against the idea of changing the concept that members have to show up to vote. You know, in the past, we've seen senators who have been wheeled in literally from their hospital beds and brought into the chamber to vote because there is no proxy voting in the Senate, as there is not also in the House. And so I think that, I think they would be very loath to go back on that because, as you say, once you kind of create a chink in that armor, it's very easy to have it all kind of, be a dramatic shift. And suddenly you have, you know, senators who are voting by proxy so they can go campaign. And I think that there's a sense that overall that's not a good thing for democracy. At the same time, though, I think that what we are seeing, to your second point, is, you know, an increase in bipartisanship right now and an increase in a willingness to work together, particularly Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin have forged I think really could be described as the most important partnership in Washington right now. And so I think that what we're seeing is, lawmakers really wanting to be able to get something done in an expeditious fashion here. And if that does happen, then I think that, you know, that does maybe decrease the need for lawmakers to be in Washington as long, and maybe does create a better ability for them to be back in town with their constituents or self-quarantining, however the case may be in the short term, if there is not as much drama over each little step in this process and they're able to move quickly. However, I do think that any kind of bipartisanship like that is going to be very short-lived. And when this crisis passes, I think we'll be back to business as usual, i.e. the gridlock in Congress.
You know, I want to ask you about something you said. You talked about important partnerships, and that is one of them. Another one that has emerged out of this is something that comes about usually when there's an emergency, and that is the public-private partnership. Do you anticipate more of these public-private partnerships cropping up without there having to be a sense of urgency or emergency?
Well, I think that, you know, again, some of these pathways that could kind of be laid down, in terms of industry and, private groups working with the government, there is the potential there for, some of the pathways that get laid down to turn into more long-lasting things once the crisis has passed. But I think these are still early days, and I think a lot of what we're seeing now is really fueled by this very, kind of grim sense that's out there about what's coming and what the implications could be for the economy and for businesses and for entire, segments of the economy. And so I think that that's really kind of greasing the skids right now. And so yeah. I think that that is likely to not necessarily continue going forward once we are able to get past the crisis.
There's a lot coming up in the coming week. It's very fluid. We're going to watch it with you. Bloomberg U.S. politics editor Kathleen Hunter, thank you for taking the time with us. That is what is happening in our nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. Want to catch more of our political coverage weekdays on Bloomberg Balance of Power from noon until 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thank you, Amy. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.